Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Death Scene by Carol J. Perry. Narrated by C.S.E. Cooney. All the world's a stage, and all the men and women merely players. They have their exits and entrances, and one man in his time plays many parts. William Shakespeare, As You Like It. Act 2, Scene 7. Chapter 1. I cranked up the radio in the Jeep, hummed along with a Taylor Swift tune, and glanced at the clock as I rounded the corner of Winter Street, pleased that I'd be checking in early for my job at WICH-TV. I'm Lee Barrett Mondello, nay, Merrily Kowalski. The Mondello part of my name is almost as new as my sweet, fully tricked-out Jeep Wrangler. My husband, Detective Sergeant Pete Mondello, and I were married less than a year ago. I'm red-haired, 35, Salem-born, and orphaned early. I was married once before, to NASCAR driver Johnny Barrett, and sadly widowed much too young. Pete and I now live on Winter Street, just a couple of blocks away from the home where I was raised by my aunt Isabel Ibby Russell. I'd almost reached the corner of Williams Street, just ahead of the looming towers of Salem's top tourist attraction, the Witch Museum, when the orange Toyota in front of me slammed on its brakes. I uttered an unladylike word, stopping the Jeep just in time to prevent damage to either vehicle. I stuck my head out the window, straining to see what was going on ahead. I recognized the Salem traffic cop who approached the Jeep, giving me a smile and a brief salute. Being married to a cop has its perks. I rolled down the window and turned Taylor Swift off mid-forever and always. "Hi, Mrs. Mondello," he said. "Looks like you might be delayed for a few minutes. The movie company is doing a shoot at the museum, and they've got the whole darned street jammed up with a tractor full of equipment, a fancy trailer, and even a food truck. We're trying to get them into some parking spaces." He leaned closer to my window, putting his finger to his lips. "I just got word that they're going to be shooting later today down at the Witch House, so you might want to stay away from that end of Essex Street, too." Of course, I knew that Paragon Productions was in town, putting the finishing touches on a film involving witches called Night Magic. Everybody in Salem knew it, and most everybody was pretty excited about it. I thanked the officer for the tip. The Witch House is the only house still standing in Salem that has a direct connection to the witch trials, and according to the station's network film critic, getting shots of the stars in and around the old house was a big part of the reasoning for bringing the cast to Salem to finish the film. Paragon's publicist had sent me a media kit of photographs of the replica room where accused witches were tried, along with some general information about the trials. I'd visited the witch house on school trips, and my librarian aunt, Ibby, had seen to it that our home library was well stocked with books about the sad witchcraft delusion that had gripped my city in 1692. The photos looked interesting, though. I put the kit in my top desk drawer for a closer look later. The movie studio couldn't have picked a worse time to film Night Magic in Salem. The entire month of October is one huge Halloween party, and people come from all over the country, maybe from all over the world, to take part in it. Pete had left for work almost an hour before I, so I was pretty sure he hadn't encountered the same delay. Even if he had, his unmarked cruiser was equipped with siren and flashing lights. The Jeep wasn't, so I put it in park and settled down for a wait. I knew for sure that Bruce Doan, the station manager at WICH-TV, loved the idea of a film about the Salem witches being made, as he put it, right in our own backyard. Easy for him to say. It wasn't anywhere close to his backyard. But on this particular morning, it was only two streets away from mine. I tuned the radio to the local station, WESX, hoping for a traffic report, and hoping, too, that this would be the only traffic screw-up between the Witch Museum and the waterfront TV studio on Derby Street. I had a fairly full schedule laid out for myself for the day. I checked the clock again. If this took more than 10 minutes, I'd start my day late. Mr. Doan likes just about everybody on the WICH-TV staff to, as he quaintly puts it, wear more than one hat. I'd already worn several, although fortunately not all at once. At the moment, my main job was program director, with an occasional stint as a field reporter. He'd recently hinted at awarding me with another title, one I'd held before, Executive Director of Documentaries. It has a fancy sound to it, but it just means that he wants me to find the time to produce a program documenting the making of a movie about witches. Information about the actual plot of the film had so far been pretty sparse, and I'd heard that the producers weren't granting interviews at all. I did, however, have one possible foot in the door of Paragon Productions. My best friend, River North, is the star of WICH-TV's late-night show, Tarot Time with River North. She hosts the Midnight Scary Movie Show and, during breaks, reads the beautiful tarot cards for call-in viewers. For years, people who know River have said that if her long black hair was platinum blonde, she'd look like a younger version of glamorous Darla Diamond, the female star of Night Magic. River is still in her 20s, and Darla is closer to my age, or maybe more. One of the advance scouts for Paragon had seen River's show, noted the resemblance, and offered her a temporary job as body double and possible stand-in for the star. It would look good on River's resume for sure, so she accepted the offer. She hadn't done any work for them yet, and I sincerely doubted that they'd welcome a local reporter and camera crew under any circumstances, but hey, River might meet somebody who knew somebody who had access to the right people. Anyway, if the documentary hat fit, I was willing to give it a try. I kept an eye on the orange Toyota in front of me, willing it to inch forward, giving me hope that this unwelcome parade might be about to break free. My 10-minute window had narrowed to 5. Horns began to sound from ahead of and behind the Jeep. The natives were getting restless. The Toyota began to move cautiously, avoiding jaywalking costumed revelers. With a thumbs-up signal from the traffic cop, I pulled off onto Hawthorne Boulevard and headed for my Derby Street destination, maybe a couple of miles an hour faster than the posted speed limit. I've been with WICH-TV long enough so that I have a designated parking space in the waterfront lot beside the station with my name on it. It still says Lee Barrett, and to the viewers of WICH-TV, that's still my name. One's own parking space is a handy thing to have, especially when there's a lot going on in Salem and drivers are apt to grab any empty space they can find. Locking the Jeep and dashing across the lot, I tapped my code into the keypad beside the entrance and stepped into the cool darkness of the studio. A burst of childish laughter issued from the distant soundstage where Ranger Rob's rodeo, the WICH-TV morning kitty show, was already in progress. I headed up the metal staircase to the second floor and pushed open the glass door marked WICH-TV Executive Offices. Rhonda, the station's receptionist, greeted me with a smile. "Doan wants to see you right away." "Is that good?" I asked. "Hard to tell." She spread out her hands in a helpless gesture. "He was on the phone with some old friend of his in Hollywood this morning, if that's any help." "Hollywood," I nodded. "Okay, then it's got something to do with the movie." "Yeah, like everything else in Salem lately. You'd think nobody ever made a movie about Salem before."
"Besides Hocus Pocus?"
"Right. And there was that Bewitched TV show where Sam and Darren come to Salem for a witches' convention," she recalled. "I loved that one," I said. "Well, I'd better go in and see what's on his mind." I headed for the door marked Station Manager and tapped on the partially open door. Mr. Doan prides himself on always having his door open to his employees.
"Come on in, Ms. Barrett. Have you begun work on our documentary yet?"
He leaned across the desk,
passed an arrangement of artificial lilacs, clearly a bit of decor inspired by his wife Buffy, who has a great fondness for the color purple.
Did you know that Lamont Faraday is a direct descendant of Nathaniel Hawthorne?
I don't think so, I said, seriously doubting that such a relationship existed between the male star of Salem's newest movie and the city's most famous author.
Bruce Doane frowned. What makes you say that?
Because I've done a little pre-documentary research lately. When Faraday was in the remake of John Wayne's The Alamo, his publicity people claimed that Davy Crockett was his great-great-great-grandfather. That wasn't true either.
So you actually think the publicity department could be putting out false information?
His expression bordered on the incredulous.
How can that possibly be?
I shrugged, trying to look noncommittal. Nobody wants to disagree with the boss. From what little I've read about this production so far, I told him, it's possible that it might be over budget already. They need all the positive pre-release publicity they can get. The TV network movie critics like that kind of interesting tidbit stuff. It'll get picked up by the cable networks, too. He frowned again. This time his whole forehead was furrowed.
Like, how much over budget?
I have no personal knowledge of it, of course, I hedged. But TMZ says several million, so far. Bruce Doane did not look pleased. I had a horrible thought. What if he's invested money in this thing? I'd heard some whisperings around the station that maybe he had. It made sense to me. The making of a movie, especially one with well-known stars, could be a huge financial blessing to the city or town involved in the filming. It meant increased business for just about every merchant or service provider in the locale. That, to Bruce Doane, would mean more advertising revenue, for sure. The success or failure of Night Magic was going to be a very big deal for Salem and for WICH-TV. Chapter 2. I left the manager's office with a promise that I'd get going right away on the documentary, with a caveat to make Salem look good. Sure, I could keep that promise, with the knowledge that everyone I'd talked to, everyone I knew in Salem, was all in for the success of the movie. From the mayor's office to the visitors' bureau to the Chamber of Commerce, along with most of the industries, retailers, and private groups, and except for some good-natured crabbiness about the traffic tie-ups, there was a spirit of cooperation throughout the city. How'd it go? Rhonda wanted to know. Not bad, I told her. He wants me to hurry up with the Salem Witches documentary. Do you think you can squeeze one more thing in today? It shouldn't take too long. She pointed to the whiteboard where she notes everybody's assignments. I was already scheduled for a meeting with the host of Shopping Salem to firm up plans for an antiques show special featuring vintage Salem souvenirs. Then, a meeting with the billing department about some past due accounts a couple of my advertisers had run up, along with the usual programming duties for the Saturday business hour, finding some cute new outfits for Paco the Wonder Dog on Ranger Rob's rodeo, and scheduling an in-person appearance with psychic medium Lorelei, who was booked to demonstrate a love spell on Tarot Time with River North. I'll try, I promised, somewhat reluctantly. What is it? Scott Palmer phoned in that he's tied up in traffic in North Salem, and he's supposed to do a stand-up at noon over at the intersection of Proctor and Boston Streets. That's where the Great Salem Fire started. The mayor is dedicating a plaque or laying a wreath or something. Not a real big deal. Howie Templeton is out of town for a college reunion. Can you do it? Big deal or not, I can't go on camera looking like this. I ran my hand through humidity-tangled, needed washing, curly red hair, then looked down at my faded jeans and short-sleeved gray sweatshirt. My present job doesn't require much of a wardrobe. Rhonda gave me an up-and-down look and didn't disagree with my assessment. Some rapid calculations told me I could keep the appointment with the Salem shopping host, postpone the meeting with the business office, phone Lorelai about the love spell, and shop online at home later for doggy costumes. I can probably rearrange the whiteboard list by 11, I said.
I might be able to get you an appointment for a quick blowout with my hairdresser, Jenna, Rhonda offered. She's very good. She does River's hair, you know.
Then you'll need to go home and grab something decent to wear.
You could make it in time. Anyway, there's no one else around to do it.
Here, I've printed out a few facts about the Great Salem Fire for you. Thanks, this will be a big help, I said, accepting the pages. Who's my ride? A field report requires a mobile unit with a camera person as well as a reporter. WICH-TV has only one fairly new rig, and I assumed Scott had that one, along with our top videographer, Francine. Is old Jim here today? Old Jim and I have worked together a number of times, and he's truly good at his job. Jim can focus on the small details that the younger photographers often miss. He drives the old VW bus that's been converted into a fair approximation of a mini mobile studio. Working with old Jim was fine with me. Rhonda assured me that Jim was on the premises, working on some editing for a Wanda the Weather Girl promo piece. Scott Palmer is not my favorite person at WICH-TV. He's a pretty good reporter, though, and he'd covered for me once in a while, back when I used to be a full-time field reporter. Howie Templeton is Scott's backup. He's also Mrs. Doan's nephew who got handed my old job the minute he graduated from broadcasting school and got me promoted to program director. I'm not complaining about it. The hours are much better for married me, and it came with a little pay raise. It's worth a shot, I guess, I told her. Want to see if Jenna can take me this morning? She was already on her phone before I'd finished the sentence. Good news. She gave me a thumbs up. She has a 10:30 cancellation, okay? Okay, I agreed, with no idea how I was going to run through that whiteboard list in half an hour. I'll be there at 10:30. Somehow, with some fancy juggling and a very cooperative Lorelai, who knows that River North, the host of Tarot Time, is my very best friend, and an always understanding Shopping Salem host, along with an annoyed but accommodating business office, I was on my way to Shea Jenna by 10:20. One of the best things about beauty parlors is the wide-ranging conversation that so often happens when your head is being shampooed, dried, and styled. Okay, call it what it is. Gossip. Pete says it doesn't work the same way at barbershops. There, it's mostly sports or politics. A good hairstylist, though, can be a better and even more reliable source of what's going on in any given place, at any given time, than any form of news media could possibly hope to be. In fact, River had told me more than once that Jenna was such a source. It turned out that on that particular day, at that particular time, the woman who'd so conveniently canceled her appointment so Jenna could fit me in was an assistant to an associate director of costuming on the very movie I'd been tasked with documenting. According to Jenna, she'd had to cancel her hair appointment because leading lady Darla Diamond, in an outburst of rage, had used a pair of scissors to rip open the seams of a custom-made evening dress because it no longer fit her properly, and she'd done what Jenna deemed a real hatchet job of it. She'd already appeared wearing the dress in critical scenes that were filmed earlier in Hollywood, so the costume department had to figure out how to somehow repair the costly designer original before they could continue filming. You'd think that a woman with such a beautiful face would have a beautiful soul, too, Jenna said. But she doesn't. It's no wonder she doesn't get along with anybody. I've heard that she and Lamont Faraday absolutely hate each other. I've heard that, too, I said. I think I read it in a magazine somewhere. It's hard to believe, though, when you see the love scenes they do together in their movies.
Yeah, there's that. They look so perfect together. Two beautiful people in love.
She sighed. You know how River looks like a much younger version of Darla, but River has a sweet disposition to go with the good looks. The thing is,
Jenna went on to explain about the dress. Darla simply gained a few pounds and the dress doesn't fit anymore. So Darla's tantrum can cost a lot of time. They've built a big temporary studio set up over in Gallows Hill Park. They even built a whole room that looks exactly like the room in the witch house where they tried the witches in 1692. Most of the story happens in the present, and they shot almost all of that part in California. The part that happens in 1692 is much shorter, just a few flashbacks that sort of parallel the things that are going on in the present. They'll be mostly shooting outdoor locations in Salem, along with a few publicity still photos of the stars and the historic houses around town. They've built a temporary wardrobe department in the park, too, and a kitchen and dining room where everybody eats. Most of the working crew have rooms in town, and they use local folks as much as they can, like the hairdressers and the caterers and the florists. There are a couple of fancy dressing room trailers for the stars on site, and they've even stocked up a supply of the expensive imported European chocolates Darla insists be on site everywhere she goes. No kidding, imported chocolates. I've heard of stars that require bowls of green M&Ms or red licorice Twizzlers, I recalled. Nothing but the best for Miss Darla, Jenna said. Maybe the chocolates account for the weight gain. Anyway, Darla has a hissy fit and the whole production gets shut down because the star is bursting the seams of a one-of-a-kind original. What a witch! The information about the current slowdown of production that had just been fed into my freshly shampooed and styled head didn't exactly fit in with what I had in mind for the documentary. But hey, a documentary is supposed to tell the truth, isn't it? I was on my way home to Winter Street by 11:05. I pulled into the parking space behind our half of the duplex house, on the same side of the street as the house where I was raised. Our big, yellow-striped gentleman cat looked up from the spot of sunshine on our back steps where he'd been sleeping. Aunt Ibby and I have a shared custody agreement about Orion. He moves, as he chooses, between the two homes. I was, as always, happy to see him, and as soon as I stepped out of the car, I picked him up and told him so. He favored me with a pink-tongued lick on my nose. I unlocked the back door, and together we entered the cheerful sun porch. Depositing the cat on his favorite zebra-striped wing chair, I hurried through the kitchen and living room and climbed the stairs to the second-floor bedroom, where I phoned Pete about what was going on. "I'll be doing a stand-up over on Proctor Street," I told him. "The mayor is commemorating the Great Salem Fire."
1914, he said. "Burned down most of the town."
How do you know things like that?
Pete is great at trivia games. I had to do a paper on it my sophomore year at Salem High School, he said.
I wish you'd saved it, I said. I'll be totally winging it on this one.
My mom probably did save it.
He laughed.
You'll be great. You always are. See you after work.
I pulled together a good enough outfit for a daytime stand-up. Tan slacks, white shirt, brown heels, and my WICHTV green jacket. I checked myself in the oval-framed full-length mirror. I felt good wearing grown-up clothes and high heels, and looked pretty good, too. Chapter 3. I made it back to Derby Street with minimum traffic foul-ups, pulling into my parking space at 11:40. Old Jim, bless him, was already in the VW, engine running at the head of the driveway, ready to roll. He waved from the window.
Come on, Lee, hop in. Let's get this show on the road.
I did as he said. Sometimes I use a clip mic, one of those little gadgets that most news anchors wear, attached to a blouse or jacket. But Jim knows I like the old-fashioned hand mic with the station's call letters on it better for outdoor stand-ups. And he had one ready for me. I fastened my seatbelt, began reading the notes about the Salem fire Rhonda had prepared, and we were on our way. Jim knows almost as many shortcuts around Salem as Pete does, so we avoided a lot of the worst traffic messes. We passed the simple memorial at Proctor's Ledge.
the site where engraved stones commemorate several of the accused witches, and approached the Boston Street intersection. Some people I recognized from other local media had already arrived. The Salem News and the Beverly Citizen reporters were there, and a guy wearing a WBZ Boston vest with a nice Sony shoulder-mounted camcorder waved hello. The historical marker, affixed to a large boulder, shows the fire alarm box used to report the start of the fire at the Corn Leather Company. The mayor was already in position to lay the wreath. It wasn't quite noon yet. We'd made it, with minutes to spare. I took my position facing old Jim's camera and waited for his signal. He counted down. 3, 2, 1. And pointed to me. I'm Lee Barrett, reporting to you from the intersection of Prospect and Boston Streets in Salem. This is the site where the first fire alarm was pulled, reporting a fire at the Corn Leather Company back in 1914. Old Jim moved in for a close-up of the plaque on the boulder. Fast-moving flames, jumping from building to building, soon consumed several more leather factories on Boston Street. The fire continued to spread, burning homes, schools, churches, businesses, I said, depending on Rhonda's notes. The mayor stepped forward to speak. Here's Salem's mayor, I said, glad that the city's top official would take over the narrative, because I didn't have much more information to offer. I learned, along with WICH-TV's viewers, that 18,000 people were left homeless when 253 acres and more than 1,000 buildings were destroyed by nightfall. The wreath was laid, the sad story told, and Jim and I were on our way back to the station by 12:15. We passed the entrance to Gallows Hill Park. I recognized the movie studio's logo on several trucks gathered around some new-looking buildings. Look, Jim, that's where the movie people have built their own little Hollywood. My hairdresser told me about it. Want to stop and take a look?
I think the new chain-link fence and the no-trespassing sign means they aren't welcoming visitors, he said. They've leased the park from the city for the whole month.
We can stand across the street and use the zoom lens, can't we? I pointed to a small crowd of people on somebody's Halloween-decorated Boston Street front lawn, standing between jack-o'-lanterns and make-believe tombstones, most with their phones focused on the posted property. Don't think we'll get anything from this distance that rate the spot in the nightly news, but it might fit in with my documentary.
Sure, why not?
Jim often humors me.
But now they've seen the WICH-TV logo on the VW, so those folks will crowd around you thinking they'll be on TV.
He was right, of course, but I did it anyway, facing the camera with my back to the chain-link-protected assembly of buildings, trucks, cars, limos, and several of those fabulous big trailers you sometimes see on the HGTV channel. Hello, Lee Barrett here, taking a look at the area Paragon Productions has created in Salem's Gallows Hill Park, while they're in Salem, filming local sites for the nearly completed motion picture Night Magic, starring Lamont Faraday and Darla Diamond. It looks as though they've built a bit of Hollywood in this hilly part of the city, where some mistakenly say witches died by hanging back in 1692. Some buildings within this fenced compound are marked with signs telling us what's going on inside. The biggest one says Soundstage. I've heard that there's a reproduction of the room in the witch house where the witches were tried inside that one. Another big one says Galley, where actors and workers have their meals. There's one that says Costumes. I pointed to it. As most moviegoers know, Paragon is famous for their costumes, often winning both Oscars and Emmys for their designs. Many of our WICH-TV viewers have reported spotting several of the actors visiting some of Salem's many attractions, restaurants, and shops. If you see one of the actors or crew, please remember that they are our guests here, and always be courteous and respectful of their private space. Jim drew a finger across his throat, giving me the familiar cut sign. A large man in uniform was fast approaching us from the park entrance.
Lee Barrett signing off, I said, realizing that it was time for Jim and me to be courteous and respectful of the production company's private space.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?